Well, Robert Reich has spent a lifetime thinking about all manner of economic questions, including one of the toughest questions facing the U.S. these days, which is the growing income disparity between rich and poor. Many of us know him from his days as Labor Secretary in President Clinton's administration. These days, he's the Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the School of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley. He's also a Senior Fellow at the Bloom Center for Developing Economies. It's an honor to welcome him back here. Secretary Reich, welcome.
Thank you, Steve. It's great to be here.
We have to begin our conversation this morning with the big news today as a Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal agreement is announced. This after years of negotiations. What are you thinking about all this as the news hits?
Well, I think it's a bad deal for most Americans, honestly. I hate to sound a sour note because it's a great achievement, but I think that most Americans will be on the losing side because the deal is primarily designed to help big corporations, global corporations, not only increase their trade, but also protect their property, their intellectual property, their patents, but not American workers. And I think American workers are going to find more jobs outsourced abroad. A lot of our health, safety, and environmental regulations may be jeopardized because there is a clause in that treaty that allows big global corporations to charge that nations are hurting their profits because health, safety, and environmental regulations get in the way.
You know, a lot of listeners are out there thinking right now, Mr. Secretary, you know, the big guys win again. What else is new? And you're telling them the little guys just lost.
Well, the little guys may lose. It's not over because the Congress still has to approve it.
And a lot of opposition to it.
And there's a lot of opposition, both Republicans and Democrats. But, you know, as I go around the country now, I'm on a book tour, and I talk to an awful lot of people. In fact, I just talked to some people in Kansas City this morning about the importance of getting our democracy back, of not simply allowing the big corporations and the big banks and the big special interests to run roughshod over the rest of us. I mean, the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership is one example, but I can tell you every day more and more decisions that are affecting average working people and the economy, regardless of whether it's the Obama administration, the Bush administration. I think the Obama administration generally has done a good job, but it's not a matter of one administration or the other. It's a matter of political power, and most people don't have it.
But what you suggest as a way to sort of combat this is sort of a mass uprising of people to sort of stand up and begin to say, we've had enough, we want our fair share, no more. And what I'm wondering is, do you sense, is there that much of a burning desire in people who have never engaged politically to finally begin to stand up and say exactly those kinds of things?
No. In fact, there's huge cynicism. Most people look at politics and they hold their nose and they say, I don't want anything to do with it. People have stopped voting, many people. But my point is that if we turn our back on politics, we are turning our back on democracy. And if we turn our back on democracy, the special interests and the moneyed interests win everything. We've got to, I think, begin a different phase of American politics. We've got to understand our economy is dependent entirely on decisions being made in Washington and in state legislatures. And there's no such thing as a market out there in the wilds, in nature. I mean, the market is dependent on rules that are decided by legislatures and judges and administrative agencies. And unless we are the ones, the vast majority are the ones that are going to have some more power over these decisions, then the special interests and the moneyed interests are the ones that are going to take it all.
Robert Reich is my guest. His new book is titled Saving Capitalism. He speaks tonight at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. All seats are gone, but you can live stream the event at youtube.com/KC Library. Rainy Day Books is the co-presenter of this event. So how do you suggest that citizens out there go about beginning to organize and rallying against exactly what you're describing as too much big corporations winning all the time?
Well, for example, I've been in the heartland here for a number of days selling my book, but also meeting with faith-based groups, with small farmers, with small businesses, with community organizers, with poor people. And the stories I hear are almost identical, regardless of who these people are. They don't yet know that their stories are identical. The small farmers don't know how much they have in common with the small businesses and the faith-based communities and the minorities, but the stories of having to deal with these huge powers that are coming in and taking over everything and siphoning off the profits and the money out of their communities and the monopolies, well, it's exactly the same thing. So you know, all I've been doing is saying to people in Missouri and Iowa and elsewhere, come together. Mm-hmm. Just come together. You're already beginning to organize. The good news is just that. People are already beginning to come together and organize. But don't let ideological blocks get in your way. Don't let racial issues get in your way. Don't let the fact that you're a farmer and not somebody from the inner city get in your way. Because you've got to get together. That's the only way we reassert political power.
What do you make of the fact, Mr. Secretary, that President Obama is such a strong proponent of this agreement? Are you surprised that he championed it?
I am a little bit, but I'll tell you, I was in the Clinton administration when the North American Free Trade Act was being pushed. And Bill Clinton, who I had a great deal of confidence in, still do, wanted that trade agreement. I think that he was under great pressure from big corporations and Wall Street. They wanted it. I can understand how even a Democratic president and somebody who I admire a great deal has to give those big corporations and has to give Wall Street something and can even persuade themselves.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting phenomenon, Stephen. I see it in Washington. You can even persuade yourself that something like this is good for most people when, in fact, it's not.
In fairness, the president says the TPP will make American companies more competitive. It'll create more jobs in the U.S. And again, you're saying, Mr. Secretary, the U.S. companies will be shipping more jobs overseas.
Well, there's a big difference between the competitiveness of U.S. companies that are global companies, have increasing numbers of workers in every country, mm-hmm. sell all around the world. Well, their competitiveness is nice. I hope they're competitive. But that has almost nothing to do with the American workforce. You can have big, very competitive, very profitable American-based companies and an American workforce that continues to lose ground. And that's exactly what's happening.
You know, you make a point very early in your new book, Saving Capitalism, that might bear some emphasis here. And that is, what's the danger when people stop believing that they and their kids have a fair shot of making it in this country? It's a scary proposition you threw out there.
It's a hugely scary proposition, mm-hmm. and it's happening right now. It's happening all over the country. People are losing faith in our political economic system. And when they lose faith in the political economic system, they can go one of two ways. One way, I think we've been talking about,
yeah.
and it's a very progressive and reformist way. And we've done that in this country before. In 1901, the progressive era, you know, we had a gilded age of robber barons, and we had huge corruption, and big corporations, monopolies were taking over. We had a lot of poverty. The middle class was shrinking. And what happened was that people rose up. They basically said, we're not going to take it anymore. And we had an era of major, important, fundamental reform, as we did again in the 1930s. But the alternative, and we've done in this country most of the time reform and changes that really get the system to work for most people. But the alternative, and other countries have had kind of right-wing authoritarian populist insurrections. Look at the 1930s. Look at Spain and Italy and Germany. I don't think we're going to go in that direction, but it is always a potential danger.
You say that the evidence of a rigged system is all around us these days. How so?
Look everywhere. I mean, we are paying in this country more for pharmaceuticals we buy than the citizens of any other advanced country, because the pharmaceutical industry has rigged the game to their advantage. They can keep their patents for longer than any other pharmaceutical industry in any other country. They are free to tell the generic producers who want to come in with cheaper versions, we're going to pay you to delay. Well, that pay for delay is itself illegal in most other countries. Or take something that is as obvious as internet service. We're paying more in this country for internet service than the citizens of any other country, and we get worse and slower service. How can that be? Because 80% of Americans don't have any choice of internet service mm-hmm. provider. Or look at food prices. I mean, you know, here we are in Missouri and in Iowa and the Midwest, and you'd think that people out here would understand and be sensitive to what's happening in the food industry. It's becoming monopolized. You have big food processors that are taking money out of the hands of small farmers and draining communities and basically sending the money globally. I mean, this is, you know, there's a huge distinction between a gigantic agribusiness and family farms. And the agribusinesses are winning and everybody else is paying the price. Almost everywhere you look in the economy, we are seeing the aggregation of economic and political power at the top. And it's got to stop.
Robert Reich, the former labor secretary, is my guest. He's here in the studio with me. 816-235-2888 is our phone number if you want to join our conversation. Again, 816-235-2888 or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Mr. Secretary, the title of your book, your new book, is Saving Capitalism. That implies that you think capitalism is in a world of hurt these days. How much hurt is it in?
Well, it's interesting, Steve. Some people respond to the title and they say, well, capitalism is just fine. And I say back, well, wait a minute. The median wage is stagnant or declining. Most people are actually doing worse than they were 10 years ago or 20 years ago. Young, even college graduates are being paid less. And there's less economic security. Everybody is worried about their jobs, their paychecks. Two-thirds of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. On the other hand, some people see the title, Saving Capitalism, and they say, why do you want to save it? And I say to them, look, even social democratic countries like Denmark and Sweden are basically capitalist. Even communist China is basically capitalist. The issue is not the ism that we put to entitle or define a system. The question is whether the system is working for the few or the many, whether it's working for just a handful of people at the top who are raking in almost all the wealth and income, and that's what's happening now, or it's working as our system did work increasingly in the 50s, 60s, and early 1970s, for the benefit of most.
You know, another key point in this book is that the market of 2015, you write in here, is very different from the market of half a century ago. How so?
Fundamentally different. If you and I were talking in the 1950s or 1960s, we would have seen, in fact, the people around us would be doing better and better. As productivity increased in the American economy, most people would be doing better. Their incomes would be rising. It was possible for, and I know because I grew up in this kind of family, one wage earner. My father was not wealthy. We were not wealthy. He had a little clothing store. But one wage earner was enough to keep a family going pretty well. We had, you know, we could have two cars. We could have modern appliances. But that's no longer the case. I mean, right now you need two incomes, and even with two incomes, you're not sure you're going to be doing very well, and a lot of people are extremely nervous. These days, most people don't feel like their children are going to do as well as they are doing or did. That's new in America. These days, CEOs of big companies are earning not 20 times the average worker. That's what the case was in the 1960s, but 300 times the average worker.
Yeah.
These days, instead of banks, like I remember our local bank, we had a bank in our town. Banks are global. They are huge. They are based in Wall Street. They frankly don't care what happens in individual communities, and they are siphoning off as much money as they possibly can from the economic base of every town and city in America.
Robert Reich, in his new book, Saving Capitalism, offers up some solutions for all this. We're going to talk about that in just a moment. But first, I want to get some phone calls here. 816-235-2888. Robert Reich, the former labor secretary, is my guest. He speaks in town tonight at the Kansas City Public Library. Let's go to some calls here. Anita from Parkville. Anita, nice to have you.
Well, thank you. And former Secretary Reich, I can't tell you how disappointed I am that I won't be able to see you in person. I've listened to you for a number of years, and I respect your work and your advice that you've given to so many leaders, whether they took it or not. The question that I have is I wanted to know, can you talk a little bit about how economic insecurity destabilizes a nation or a country and why that's bad for national security? And why people vote against their own interest. And I'll take my question offline. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for the call, Anita. I appreciate it. How does economic instability destabilize a nation?
Most people become very afraid, honestly, naturally, if they don't know where their next paycheck is coming from, or they don't know how much they're going to earn, or they don't have regular work hours, and that's increasingly the case, then they're not going to turn around and buy very much because they are afraid. And if you don't have a vast middle class and working class and poor able to buy, well, then who's going to buy all the goods and services that are being produced? That's one reason that the economy is as sluggish as it is, why this recovery was among the most sluggish and disappointing recoveries we've had. The other aspect of that is you can't have a secure nation internationally if you don't have secure people, if you don't have people who feel that they can trust the system and feel that they want to participate and feel optimistic and good about their economic prospects.
But can the economy recover, Mr. Secretary, under these circumstances where there's this huge income disparity between the super wealthy and the rest of us?
No, because if all or almost all the income and wealth is going to the top, then
that economic engine's missing.
You don't have the purchasing power in the middle and the bottom. I mean, you know, some people cling to this notion that if you give tax breaks to people at the top, it'll trickle down to everybody else. Well, nothing trickles down. We've seen it. We've tried it. Some people cling to the notion that the job creators are the captains of industry, the CEOs. Well, they're not to the job creators. The job creators are the vast middle class and the poor who buy. And if they don't buy, if they don't have enough money to buy, then there's going to be no jobs created because there's no incentive on the part of any business to create more jobs because there are not enough customers.
Anita's other question had to do with voters voting against their own self-interest. That's an argument that Tom Frank made in his book, What's the Matter with Kansas? How do you explain that?
I think that we are being divided racially, ethnically, religiously, politically. And these divisions, while understandable, they are working against our understanding of a common economic interest. The bottom 90% of Americans really do have to, and this is a central principle of my book, the bottom 90% of Americans have a huge amount in common economically. If we unite, if we get together, if we overcome these divisions, then we really have a chance to take back our democracy and take back our economy.
Let's go back to some calls. And Tim from Olathe has a question about trickle-down economics. Tim, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Well, thank you, Tim.
Well, Mr. Secretary, my question was very similar to Anita's, so you may have already addressed many of these things, but I was reading in your book, Reason, and then in your DVD, Inequality for All, kind of how the trickle-down doesn't necessarily work because these champions of the industry, as we call them, they're not just creating jobs out of the kindness of their own heart. It's when there's increased purchasing power in us purchasers, that's what drives the jobs. So they're not just going to create a job unless there's a demand for more output. So I was wondering if we could kind of steer at that. Like I've been arguing a lot with people on the minimum wage, and they don't want it to increase, and states are, a state like Missouri is fighting Kansas City, telling them they won't allow them to raise their minimum wage. To me, it just makes a lot more sense when we give money in the hands of the many, more many will buy.
Well, I think, Tim, you're exactly right. And evidence shows that when you raise the minimum wage, it puts more money in the hands of more people. And that additional money is spent, and it's spent mostly locally, and that generates more jobs. In 1996, when I was Secretary of Labor, we raised the minimum wage. Hadn't been raised in years. A lot of people forecast that that would be a job destroyer. But actually, after we raised the minimum wage, 22 million net new jobs were created. Now, I'm not saying that they were created because the minimum wage was increased. I'm just saying that the minimum wage increase was not a job destroyer. And it's so important to people. The idea that in this country we should have huge numbers, millions of Americans who are working full-time but are still in poverty is violative of the basic moral compact we have. I mean, our economy is premised on some fundamental ideals and ideas. One is that if you work full-time, you shouldn't be poor.
Robert Reich, the former Labor Secretary, is my guest. Has anybody ever told you you've got great pipes? I mean, you're just great radio, Mr. Secretary. You just not a or ah in any answer you give.
You be careful, Steve, because I'll just get, you know, I could take your job one day.
I was going to say, you might wind up over here very, very quickly here. Let's talk about some of the solutions that you suggest in saving capitalism. One is going to be controversial, paying all Americans a guaranteed annual income. That's going to rile some people up.
Well, it obviously will rile some people up, but eventually we're going to have to do it because technologies are being advanced so quickly that take the place of labor. And I would say probably in the next 30 or 40 years, we're going to have something that maybe we'll call an iEverything, you know, a little device that will be able to do everything. You just say what you want and presto, you get it, kind of like a little Aladdin's lamp. The problem is nobody will be able to afford it or even buy it because nobody will have a job, you see. So we have to have some way of recirculating money. In the 20th century, the economic system we had was based on mass production, mass consumption, and workers were consumers, and it all worked. But as we move into a new economy in which more and more is being done by machines, technology, advanced, complex 3D manufacturing, people are going to have fewer jobs. And so a basic minimum income is something that we're going to have to consider.
You also propose a payment of royalties into the public domain as the cost of holding a patent. What's your thinking there?
Well, it's the same thing, really, that patents, it's a form of property. It's the new form of property that is the basic building block of the new economy. There's no logical reason why a patent should be 20 years. I mean, you could have a patent 15 years. In fact, these are sort of, in fact, they are monopolies. And if we took a piece of the royalties of patents, the revenues that come out of patents, and basically recirculated those in the form of a guaranteed minimum income, there you have at least the outcome of a system that 20 or 30 or 40 years from now could sustain the economy.
Is that a politically viable option, do you think? Would Congress ever go along with it?
Well, nothing is politically viable
until
the public demands it. I mean, I was Secretary of Labor. You would think that being in a cabinet, you would have the power to do whatever you wanted. Well, obviously, you can't. The public has got to be organized and mobilized and understand the issues, or else the special interests, the moneyed interests, dominate.
Back to some phone calls here. Let's go to Ron from Overland Park. Ron, you're on Up to Date.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Nice to have you, Ron. Go ahead.
Dr. Reich, I am a great admirer, but I would really appreciate your answering the question that I have, which is, you know, generally I think most people, informed people, agree that the primary issue of the 21st century is wealth inequality. But is the solution generally more access to education, or is it a political solution? You know, such measures as you're promoting, such as a tax reduction.
Ron, I don't think you can take the politics out of the economy. An economy is run by rules. Those rules come from legislators and judges and administrative agencies. So the real question is, what rule changes do we need to make the economy work better for more people? And one of the things that I've suggested this morning is we have more vigorous antitrust. We get rid of the big monopolies that in agriculture and in many other facets of our economy are now draining the pocketbooks of most people. Another thing we need to do is to take a very hard look at patents and trademarks and reduce those patents and give people more rights to access high-tech goods and gadgets. A third thing we need to do is obviously invest in education, but not just pour more money into education. We've got to make sure that education works. I think some of the heroes, at least in my way of looking at the economy in our society, some of the real heroes are teachers. Now, teachers have taken a lot of flack in recent years, but the people I know who are teaching are are dedicated and they are working for a small fraction of the kinds of money that some people in finance, for example, are earning. I mean, you know, you have a $1 billion a year hedge fund manager who is raking in money. And what is that hedge fund manager doing? Well, taking money out of one pocket and putting it into another pocket. I mean, it's all finance. But a teacher is dealing with our human capital, the future of our country. So obviously, we've got to invest in education.
You know, people will be curious, Mr. Secretary, have you endorsed in the 2016 presidential race?
I haven't, Stephen, partly because I'm chairman of an organization called Common Cause. It's a nonpartisan citizens organization that is trying to get big money out of politics.
Robert Reich's new book, his latest book, Saving Capitalism. He speaks tonight at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. The seats are gone. You can stream it live, youtube.com/KC Library. Rainy Day Books is a co-presenter of this event. What a pleasure to have you here, Mr. Secretary.
Great to
Thanks
be
very
here.
Much. Appreciate
Stephen,
it.
Stephen, thank you.